It's a difficult thing to choose some of the worst defeats for the Imperium of Man, especially when the term defeat could be interpreted relatively subjectively. What we are considering today are not solely battles and combat engagements that led to crushing disasters suffered by Imperial military forces, but events so severe that they would be scratched into the collective memory in blood. There are so many such events that it would take us many hours to compile a truly comprehensive ordering. Often the Imperium will go on to win ultimate victory for many of its campaigns, usually through sheer gritted teeth and attrition. Pyrrhic victories are commonplace for mankind, but even if victory in a battle is the final outcome, the associated costs for this may take decades or even centuries to recover from. I'll be looking at today some memorable disasters, not necessarily always on the most epic of scales, but the most humiliating or staggering defeats, heavy, reeling gut punches that would knock the wind out of humanity's forces, leaving them gasping for air, choking on their own blood. If you have some specific other disasters for the Imperium that you want me to look at that I don't cover today, then as per usual, discuss it in the comments. If you have ideas for another best of the worst, put that down below too. In the early days of the Horus Heresy, there had been few major conflicts between the Space Marine Legions of the Emperor and what would become the Traitor Legions commanded by Horus Lupercal. The Dropsite Massacre was a devastating conflict which occurred early in the Heresy and would become an unquestionable action that meant none could ignore the truth of things any longer. It followed the atrocities of Istvan III, where Horus had instigated a battle between the loyalist elements of the legions that would turn against the Emperor, namely the Sons of Horus, the Death Guard, Emperor's Children and the World Eaters. This would culminate in the virus bombing of the planet, a horrifically fast form of Exterminatus, where the virus bombs release a life-eater virus which will break down all organic matter, consuming the planet and turning it into a barren, dead rock, albeit habitable after the virus has burned itself out of material to consume. This would be the engagement where Nathaniel Garrow would see the truth of things and flee aboard the Eisenstein, eventually meeting with the Imperial Fists and Rogor Dorn to deliver the news to the Emperor on Terra, where they would realise the truth of the betrayal. As a consequence, the Emperor would order the forces of 7 Space Marine Legions to assault Horus and his Traitor Legions, where they currently operated in the Istvan system. The Istvan V assault would be carried out by the Loyalist Astartes Legions, the Iron Warriors, Raven Guard, Alpha Legion, Night Lords, Salamanders, Iron Hands, and the Wordbearers. The Emperor believed the combined power of 7 of his legions would quickly bring the traitors to heel, and the whole situation could be prevented from becoming any worse. Of course, the only problem, unbeknownst apparently to the all-knowing Emperor, was that the Primarchs and many ranking officers of the Iron Warriors, Alpha Legion, Night Lords, and Wordbearers had already betrayed the Imperium and secretly pledged their service to Horus. The traitors believed the Imperium was fundamentally flawed. It was founded on deceit by the Emperor himself and its so-called Imperial truth of rationalism and atheism that was all a lie. They felt they had seen the real truth. This new human civilization did not deserve to live. They would forge a far more powerful and righteous empire for mankind. At this time, it's questionable how many truly understood the gravity of their actions in terms of how much they knew about the warp and the chaos gods. Only really the Wordbearers and Horus himself had the real understanding of what it would all entail, and by this time so many were fully committed to the cause, it would be entirely too late to change course. The assault would begin in an area known as the Urgar Depression, a narrowed valley where the traitors had set up a bastion of defence. Behind them were established long-range support units, and Titans stood along the walls as well as bearing their guns bigger than most vehicles, trained on where the Loyalist deployment was expected to come in. An initial heavy bombardment from orbit did little to shake the traitors loose from their heavily constructed defences, and it was clear that this was going to be a battle where every inch of ground must be paid for in blood. The first assault rained down from the skies as thousands of drop pods and ships began to deploy the loyalists of the Iron Hands, Salamanders and Raven Guard, while later the Iron Warriors, Night Lords, Alpha Legion and Wordbearers would drop in to hold a rearguard position and reinforce this first wave. The battlefield was an instant slaughter of apocalyptic proportions. Titans of the Mechanicum and Dark Mechanicum stalked the battlefield like true machine gods, raining down world-ending firepower. The legions of the Astartes were so massive and the battle so horrific, thousands were dying by the minute. This was a fairly even fight after the initial deployment, and no side was faring especially well. All had to pay a heavy price. Any lost ground would be immediately countered as this grisly battle of attrition continued unabated. Indeed, the battle was so ferocious and on simply such a scale that any auxiliary non-Astartes human contingents struggled to cope with the sights they were faced with here at the drop site. It wasn't so much fear as it was just beyond their comprehension to process what it was they bore witness to right here. Some were frozen like statues, numbed by the sheer waste of life, so many glorious lords of mankind broken like dolls and scattered, throwing themselves against their enemy time and again. Others just lost their minds, overcome by the sights that they'd never imagined that they would ever see, and were shot by overseers. This was never a fight for ordinary men, it was a battle between Astartes, and its scale and ferocity was appropriately multiplied. As the sky turned black, the loyalists roared with cheers that shook the very ground as their reinforcements had arrived. Deploying behind them en masse to guard and push forward, the four other legions had begun to deploy to the field. The traitor forces began to withdraw now, thinking that they would be instantly overwhelmed by such a massive force, and they would have been, were it not for the fact that these reserve forces were no longer loyal to the Emperor of Man. They lined up behind the loyalists, who were slowing their assault to allow the fresh, unscarred forces to take up the fight and allow them time to regroup and press a final attack. As Horus fired a bright burning red flare into the sky, a hellish burning star, thousands of barrels began firing down on the loyalist marines, many of whom were carrying dead and wounded back to the safety of these fresh brothers to the battle. They were instantly torn to pieces by the hail of bolt shells exploding and ripping them apart. The retreating traitors now turned back to continue the fight, and the Iron Hands, who had been caught up by their fierce desire to crush these betrayers of the Emperor, were now heavily outnumbered. The situation only deteriorated from here. Many loyalists were crawling around, cut down and critically injured by the already suffocating weight of fire being brought down upon them, and this would only be compounded further by more fire and more laser rounds being laid down by land raiders, predators, speeders and bastion turrets that sought to finish the task at hand. Somewhere, lost in the battlefield of brothers slaughtering one another, clashed Ferus and Fulgrim, two Primarchs whose blades whirled around them, the light of horror, the reds and oranges from the fire of war reflecting and bouncing off their armour and swords. Korax and Lorgar would fight their own battle, with Lorgar coming close to death, and were it not for curse of the Night Lords, he would have certainly died that day. Gunships continued to rain down cluster bombs, dreadnoughts, battered tanks. It was a firestorm of carnage. Explosions rained across the battlefield in a never-ending hailstorm of destruction. The initially even battle had turned into a doomed massacre, and Korax of the Raven Guard, Vulcan of the Salamanders, knew all they could hope for now was to escape the slaughter. The heresy had begun in truth here on Istvan V. Horus had succeeded in the almost complete destruction of three of the nine remaining loyalist legions in one single battle. The remaining loyalists refused defeat. They fought on, knowing their annihilation was inevitable, but they would make the traitors pay for every single life they took. The battlefield was an unrelenting storm of fire and blood. Titans continued to obliterate scores of enemies with every shot as they continued rampaging across the killing fields. Once victory was assured, even Horus himself took to the battlefield, surrounded by his Terminators and whatever remained of his Mournival. He stalked the battlefield, crushing the weak and pitiful who stood to oppose him. Meaningful escape was all but impossible. A few scattered units managed to get off of the field, but their orbiting vessels and dropships had fared just as poorly as they themselves. Still, some did manage to escape, the Raven Guard faring better than the Salamanders or the Iron Hands. The Salamanders had managed to survive well until the closing stages of the massacre, when they would become encircled, the Primarch Vulcan at their centre. They were increasingly crushed under a sheer weight of fire, and the coup de grace would be delivered by the Iron Warriors, who would launch a tactical nuclear strike directly at the centre of their position, completely destroying any Salamanders who remained. Vulcan the Primarch, though, would survive, to be unconsciously dragged from the battle by Conrad Kurz of the Night Lords. hundreds of thousands of Space Marines littered the battlefield, a Primarch among them, two others missing, assumed also dead. It was one of the most devastating defeats for the Imperium, not only for the losses, but also for the crushing defeat of the Emperor's dream. Hydra Caudatus was an Imperial forge world. More importantly, it was used to store gene seed by the Adeptus Mechanicus, in this instance, the Imperial Fists chapter. Early in M31, Primarch of the Imperial Fists Rogal Dorn had brought the planet's rulers into the system of the Imperial Planetary Government. As was the norm for the Crusades, Iterators and Remembrancers travelled the world, encouraging the Imperial truth. Dorn would leave behind Captain Felix Cassander to stand watch over this new world. Yet unknown to them, Horus the Warmaster had by now fallen to chaos and was instigating a galactic rebellion against the Emperor and the Imperial forces. This was when Rogal Dorn would command all of his Imperial Fists to return to Terra to aid in preparing defences against any assault by the traitors. Felix, though, would find him and his Imperial Fists on Hydra, stranded as a result of the death of his navigator. He now had no means to travel through the warp and had to await a replacement. As news arrived of the horrors being committed by the traitors, for Felix and his detachment of Imperial Fists, the frustration of their isolation only grew. Yet soon enough, they had their chance to fight, as the Iron Warriors would arrive to begin saturation bombing of the planet. The civilians of Hydra, who had only recently with much joy found themselves once again as part of a galactic human empire and were ready to embrace such a positive reconnection, wholeheartedly now remembered the horrors of man. The Iron Warriors began dropping magma bombs, boiling away rivers, and reducing the land to dust. Despite only being some 200 strong, the Imperial Fists and their human auxiliaries would make the Iron Warriors pay dearly for their betrayal. Staying strong in their citadel fortress, they would stand firm for 3 months as the Iron Warriors continued to assault and lay siege to the fortress. Yet over time, losses inevitably mounted, regrettable but understandable given the scale of force they were attempting to hold out against. Cassander understood that when the last stand came, it would not be glorious or heroic, only a slaughter. Eventually, the Iron Warriors would inevitably overrun the defences, and they slaughtered any who remained. Loyalist Astartes, men and women of the defence forces, and the refugees from the scoured landscape outside the city, all would perish. At this time, only 52 Imperial Fists Marines had remained, along with some 13,000 men, women, and children inside the city itself. Any survivors were enslaved, and the planet would be reduced to a barren desert world. At the end of the Heresy, it would be converted to a Mechanicus research station and vault for the Imperial Fist gene seed. The defence by the Imperial Fists on Hydra Caudatus had been admirable, but ultimately a crushing defeat. However, the interesting aspect is that history would repeat itself, and the Masters of Defence seemed to not learn anything from their previously crushing defeat. Because some 10 millennia later, at the end of M41, as part of the 13th Black Crusade, the Iron Warriors would return to Hydra Caudatus under orders from Abaddon. They would assault and attempt to steal the Imperial Fist's gene seed stored securely here, because the Iron Warriors needed new gene seed in order to increase their numbers. This is an ever ongoing problem for Chaos forces, is their inability to easily replenish their numbers. The warp and the Chaos powers often cause severe mutations within the gene seed, and as such, many Chaos traitor legions are unable to use it to create new Space Marines. Once again, the defenders were outnumbered by the traitors, and a vast battle including immense Titan war machines would ensue. Fierce fighting and the titanic machines led to the death of multiple notable Iron Warrior officers, but the Imperial Fists paid a far heavier price as the entire Third Company is slaughtered here. The Mechanicus, who arrive to discover the aftermath, decide to bomb the remaining citadel into dust so that nothing would remain of the shame of such a loss. Only a lone Imperial Guardsman survived the brutal onslaught. He was found by an Imperial Fist relief force and taken from the blasted surface of Hydra Caudatus. This defeat sends shockwaves through the Imperial Fists, felt most keenly by those captains who had forged these Sentinels of Terror. This is without even mentioning the unspeakable traitorous filth of Chaos, who had by now stolen the stored samples of the Imperial Fist's gene seed. It was a completely crushing, and with all respect to the Valiant dead, an unforgivable defeat. But it was one which the Imperial Fists would seek to immediately repay by launching a campaign of white-hot fury and vengeance upon the Iron Warriors, scouring them from anything like a dozen worlds across the edges of the Eye of Terror. The new and inexperienced 3rd Company recruits would quickly earn new honours in their defence of the Phalanx, the fabled Imperial Fist's battle station. As a warp rift is torn within the centre of the vessel itself, greedy demon princes, one of whom being a foul former Iron Warrior, pour forth along with their demon kin seeking to upstage Abaddon's Black Crusade and use the Imperial Fist station to launch an attack on Terra and the Emperor's palace itself. The previously annihilated but now reforged 3rd Company fight a furiously bitter battle, as the Phalanx is taken into the Immaterium and the fresh recruits face unspeakable horror at every turn, yet the spectral fire of the Legion of the Damned bursts forth, appearing without even having been aware of it, and they lay down their legendary holy fire upon the demon entities of Chaos. The 3rd Company is invigorated, yet ultimately victory was even now uncertain. The Battle of Lion's Gate was not a strict defeat in terms of physical loss, but it was a crushing mental defeat. After the heresy and the scouring of the traitors from the galaxy, pushing them back into the Eye of Terror, it had been largely assumed that Terra was largely well protected from such incursions. They had very heavy defences and felt relatively invulnerable. The 13th Black Crusade, brought about by Abaddon the Despoiler, wrought terrible destruction on the Imperium, not least for the destruction of Cadia and formation of the Great Rift, which would tear the galaxy in half, bleeding the warp into reality. The Gods of Chaos, filled with refreshed power from the devastation of Cadia and the newfound freedom to enter the galaxy from so many inlets, allowed warp storms to form over Terra itself. A terrifying and unforeseen consequence, not to mention a price to be paid by the Imperium and the High Lords of Terra for their many millennia of enforced ignorance and resistance to science and the accumulation of knowledge. Had Belisarius Kall and others in the Mechanicus like him been given free rein to investigate and develop new tech, they would have perhaps come to an understanding earlier of the Blackstone pylons and prevented the devastation unleashed by their destruction. Regardless, it was too late for any of that now. The damage of mankind's ignorance was done, and there would be consequences. Chaotic madness would spread like wildfire across Terra. Only the Imperial Palace itself was shielded, likely by the Emperor's power. Mass rioting orgies of destruction and depravity ensued. It felt like the Age of Strife all over again. Men being flayed in the streets, women dragged off into the dark corners of cities, wholesale murder, gore, the stuff of nightmares. These sights should never have been seen on Terra again, not in the glory of the Emperor's Imperium. It was a true horror. Terra itself had ceased to be able to produce its own food source long ago and was reliant on shipping to import much of its necessary supplies. The disorder gripping the planet didn't help, but history would repeat itself when the warp storms prevented much of the necessary supplies coming in, and so starvation and anarchy began to plague the civilian population even more so. Cathedrals and churches across the planet began to be converted into shrines for the dark gods. The Imperial forces were quickly losing control of the situation. Not even the custodes or Imperial Fists ventured outside of the Imperial Palace, as the entirety of Holy Terra was at war with itself. And then Korn struck out at Terra. He wanted to assert dominance over the other gods, and consequently mass bloody sacrifices ensued. Millions of guardsmen lay with their hearts cut out. The streets were awash with blood for the Blood God. The warp storms only worsened until demons were pouring from the skies, and their target was, of course, the Imperial Palace itself. Despite millennia of inactivity, the defences of the Lion's Gate were strong. The Custodes and Grey Knights would lead the defence and charge out to counter the demonic hordes. Robert Gulliman, Ultramarines Primarch, descended from Luna after his battle with Magnus the Red and would join the Imperium's finest in countering the horrors of the warp, along with his own Ultramarines and the Sisters of Silence. The demons who had failed to breach the Imperial Palace, Khorne, so enraged, obliterated the Bloodletters who had led the battle. While technically an Imperial victory, the Battle of Lionsgate was a devastating mental defeat. Holy Terror is the very centre of the Imperium. It was meant to be a pure and untouchable holy site. The Emperor resides here, and instead, through the stubborn ignorance of the Imperium, and more widely the Ecclesiarchy, the resistance to knowledge and science, the lack of development and strength in the Imperium, human weakness had allowed Terror to be essentially brutally raped by the gods of chaos. The planet was a mess. Blood washed like an ocean through the streets. Citizens who were coming back to their senses saw what they had done. Mass suicide would ensue. It was a catastrophic disaster by any measure, but mostly by humanity in the wake of the Horus heresy, the religious belief and faith that the Emperor of Man would be the only guiding force required by mankind, even as he sat upon his corpse throne, was shockingly misplaced. The Battle of Beta Garmon occurred shortly after the drop site massacre on Istvan V. It would be one of the largest battles of the heresy. Alpha Legion cruisers had entered the Beta Garmon star cluster, a region settled by humans during the Dark Age of Technology, and a region that survived the Age of Strife relatively intact. It made a peaceful and open transition into the burgeoning Imperium and was home to stable warp routes that enabled entry into the Sol system and Terra. For this reason, it was significantly important strategically. The Alpha Legion would initiate their standard tactics of stealth and precision assassination to destabilize the area in preparation for the Emperor's children and elements of the Legion Mortis, who would also deal crippling damage to the Imperial army and its orbiting star fort over Beta Garmon II. The ensuing confusion and power struggle surrounding all of this initial contact led many of the planets in the system to collapse, as was commonplace during the heresy, into all-out civil war. Over a period of years, the traitors would bombard the planets without much concern for who suffered the consequences. Many dire events would be inflicted upon the civilian populations and their defensive armies. Great starvations, soul plagues, and the rain of plasma would all strike down to the ordinary individuals trying to understand their place in these apocalyptic events. During the heresy, Lorgar would orchestrate a major warp storm known as the Ruin Storm. The goal was to divide and isolate loyalist forces, and it proved very effective. Its impact on the Beta Garmon cluster was no less significant. It trapped loyalist marines and Titan assets here, and they had little choice than to do the best they could and assign themselves to defending the loyalist forces here against ever-increasing numbers of traitors. Primarch Rogal Dorn would order a detachment of Imperial Fists as well as Salamanders to engage the Emperor's children at the massive garrison of Nirkon City on the now traitor-occupied Beta Garmon II. Across the planet and on other worlds like Beta Garmon III, fighting continued on a mass scale, often involving Titan conflicts leading to many thousands of dead, Titans themselves lost or destroyed, and after many months of bitter fighting, the traitor's stranglehold on Beta Garmon 2 and 3 would be broken. The Ruin Storm would later weaken, and it allowed for the first reinforcements to arrive to the Beta Garmon cluster, but this does little to give any reprieve to either side, and if anything, the fighting only became more bitter and intense as more loyalist human Imperial troops switched sides in the hopes of saving themselves, as the traitors also continue to pour in their own reinforcements. Rumours are abound of Horus the Warmaster's own arrival swirling through populations. A vanguard fleet arrives and begins bombarding the outlying worlds of the Beta Garmon cluster. The damage this fleet inflicts forces Imperial commanders to split their force and reduce the defensive capabilities set up around the core worlds of Beta Garmon 2 and 3. The second phase of the conflict, though, would make these initial stages look like a skirmish by comparison. At this time, Rogal Dorn was awaiting reinforcements from Gulliman and the Lion, and he would make his stand as Titans stood, towering over Imperial defences as the primary force. These Titans concerned Dorn most especially if they were to be used ever on Terra, because while Titans were war machines of apocalyptic stopping power, they were so powerful they were often a danger to friendly forces and even planets themselves, such was the insane power and scale of their weaponry. Battles in the history of the Imperium were often large, but it cannot be overstated how massive the battles of Beta Garmon would be. On the Imperial side, they wielded anything like 27 Titan Legions, at least 20 Imperial Nighthouses, Mechanicum Imperial Army Forces, and elements of the Blood Angels, White Scars, Imperial Fists, and Salamanders. The Traitors wielded dozens of Titan Legions themselves, at least as many Nighthouses, a Traitor Imperial Army, and the Sons of Horus, Iron Warriors, Wordbearers, and the Emperor's Children. The conflict would be a literal apocalypse. Not long after his arrival, Horus would initiate a massive assault towards the now Imperial-occupied Nerkon city on Beta Garmon II. Traitor Imperial armies swept across the planet assaulting Hive cities, while the Traitor Titans broke a 100-kilometer defensive line of Loyalist Imperial forces. Despite its formidable defences, the sheer scale of assault laid down by the Titans, blackening and annihilating those who even tried to resist them, the very earth cracked as they stormed over the mortal men who could barely comprehend what they were witnessing. Anywhere their weapons engaged turned the very sand to glass and vaporised all organic matter. Their irresistible force shatters the defences of Nerkon, and the city is opened for the traitors to pour in. The city is lost in very short order, and not long after, the planet itself is back in the hands of the traitors. Beta Garmon III remains in Loyalist hands as the Titan Legion of the Nova Guard stand resolute, despite bombardments and siege assaults by the Sons of Horus and Iron Warriors. So Horus instead turns his attention to the outlying planets. The Loyalists can do little other than to throw whatever they have available into their defences there. But the ensuing raids and defense organizations around these outlying planets are disorganized bloodbaths. Beta Garmon III would become the focus of a prolonged engagement now, as multiple Titan legions battle for control of the planet. And so many vessels were destroyed that were previously orbiting the planet, that for a time even the remnants and debris falling down onto the planet from orbit would become a problem for those on the surface, as the huge pieces of starship came crashing down to the surface. The Iron Warriors would engage the Loyalist Titans again with siege battalions at long range, and finally, the Dark Mechanicum would initiate a solar event, blinding Loyalist Titans and their sensor systems. The traitor Titan Legion of the Tiger Eyes would now engage the Loyalists, who would fight to the last. The conflict here was a costly and grinding affair, but after many months it was clear that the traitors were slowly turning the tide in their favour. Loyalist reinforcements were arriving in an unpredictable and fragmented way, making it very difficult to properly reinforce and plan counter-assaults. Internal command structure issues were also becoming a problem with the Loyalists. Leading princeps refusing to work under the authority of other legion commanders, the traitors cared little for such petty power squabbles by contrast. They simply wanted to annihilate the Loyalists, for their sole authority was Horus himself. Finally, arriving much later than expected due to the instability of the warp, the Blood Angels and White Scars would arrive with their fleets, and they set about immediately reassessing the situation. Sanguinius, the Blood Angels' Primarch, took command. On Beta Garmon II, the Blood Angels now and some 30 Titan Legions fought to capture the planet and retake it again for the Imperium. Despite their best efforts of orbital assault bombarding the planet heavily, most of the traitors suffered minimal damage. Despite their gargantuan force of Titans, they were countered by a force of equal size, heavily entrenched, waiting for them at Nerkon City. The ensuing battle involved anything like 1,000 Titans fighting across the now ruined and scarred landscape of Beta Garmon II. The sights and actions of such a conflict are truly difficult to describe in words. The scale of the conflict and the power of the giant war machines beyond the comprehension of an ordinary citizen. But it's enough to say that the battle would be later bleakly designated as Titan Death. In orbit of Beta Garmon II, the vast star fort known as the Anvil would see its own internal conflict between the Blood Angels and the Sons of Horus. But the defending force found by the Blood Angels here was far less than they had anticipated. With little time to spare, they realized it was a trap and evacuated in time to see the space station detonate. The volume of debris that came crashing down to the surface of Beta Garmon II inflicted heavy damage on both sides. And for all of this apocalyptic warfare, Beta Garmon II had been a distraction, as it now became apparent that the traitor's real target was Beta Garmin III, for here served the Astropathic Choir, the Loyalist communications centre. Horus's traitors would detonate a vortex bomb. Vortexes are some of the deadliest weapons to exist in the far future, and they function by tearing a hole in reality. Anything coming into contact with a vortex tear is torn out of real space and shredded as it's dragged into the warp itself. The result of all this would be knocking out the void shields protecting the major city of Caldera Primus on Beta Garmin III. Horus, along with his legion and 100 titans of Legio Mortis, would now assault the city. While the Imperials had their own titans defending the city, the Imperial army defense was overwhelmed, and Horus would succeed in his goal of destroying the Imperial communications center. By now on Beta Garmin II, the Loyalists were significantly demoralized. Sanguinius and Khan accepted that most of their forces had been destroyed, and Beta Garmin III was now in the hands of the enemy, as well as the communications choir being broken or controlled by the traitors. Dawn's plan to hold these traitors and buy time had run out of time, and so the Loyalists would be forced to retreat and withdraw from the Beta Garmin cluster with any materials and manpower they could gather while fighting running space and ground battles with the traitors. In this conflict, Horus had secured a major victory in the Beta Garmin cluster, not only securing the communication center of the Imperium, but also the gateway to the Sol system itself, which would soon lead to the Siege of Terror. While ultimately a victory for the traitors and a loss for the Imperials, the casualties were immense on both sides. The civilian death count for both Loyalist and traitor was in the billions. Titan legions were heavily crippled, with thousands of war machines and their operators being destroyed. It was simply one of the largest battles ever fought by humanity in the history of the Imperium of Man. The War of the Beast was a massive warg around the period of M32. During the 32nd millennium, humanity and the Imperium were still trying to recover and reorganize itself after the gut punch that was the Horus Heresy. Not simply in terms of repairing physical damage, but also heavy restructuring would occur at all levels. This made it less stable for many reasons. The Imperium, however, did feel that it had endured, survived, and emerged victorious from its greatest threat. Xenos were generally still considered an irritation and nothing more. The sense of the power of mankind at this time was still very strong, but as is all too often the case, this arrogance leads to a dangerous underestimation of the enemies of man. Orcs especially are regularly underestimated, and it's true that moderate rampages by orcs inflict easily resolvable damage and are not especially difficult to contain. For orcs, it's really a case of staying on top of things and managing them as a threat. Even then, destroying a small orc force and allowing others to escape is rarely a sound plan, because they'll often return, and in greater numbers. The Imperial Fists had been conducting an ongoing campaign of Xenos purging as they battled an insectoid form known as the Chromes. The Imperial Fists had already suffered a severe kicking at the hands of these Chrome insectoids, leaving them humiliatingly decimated. The remaining Imperial Fists chapter was dispatched to aid the brothers on Ardamantur. But the planet became consumed by gravitational storms, and these would turn out to be a result of an orc planetoid, otherwise known as an attack moon, which materialized around the planet's orbit and quickly would begin laying waste to it. Now, attack moons are massive orc vessels that are essentially planetoids that have been hollowed out and constructed, converted into massive drifting war stations. Their construction is far from simple, as they're forged through a process of placing one gravitic nexus into orbit and another on the surface of a planet, which would send the contents of the doomed world into space to be then reformed into a massive spacecraft. The technical knowledge to construct such ships baffled the Imperium and the Mechanicus. How such savage creatures were able to construct such complex war machines was way beyond their understanding of what orcs should be capable of. But as with most things that are orc, it's because these planetoid attack moons were not really some end-designed product. They were just experimentations, as are most orc creations. These just happened to be quite effective. They also operated as an end exit point for orc subspace tunnels titled Warg Gates by the orcs themselves. What this means is that through the power of Warg, the orcs could use these stations to deploy endless waves of orcs, warships, warcraft, war machines. They even featured their own gravitic weapon known as a gravitic whip, a lashing gravity weapon that could decimate Imperial cruisers and battleships. The remaining Imperial fists on the planet did their best in a last-ditch struggle against the now panicked Chromes, and the strange gravity forces were intensifying. Not long after Orcs began to appear on the planet would they slaughter the remaining Imperials. A broken message was somehow sent out informing the Imperium that it was facing a dire threat, like none before. The arriving reinforcements were no match for the vast Orc menace that they had severely underestimated. The Imperial fleet was ruined, and the Imperial Fist chapter annihilated. This in itself was a devastating defeat for the Imperium. The Orc moon began to phase out and would begin to move towards its next destination, Terra. The Imperium would learn that in fact more than one Orc attack moon existed, not the news that anybody wanted to hear. The Orc campaign of violence was swift and severe. They swarmed entire systems and slaughtered any and all that stood in their path. The strange gravitic psychic properties of the Orc attack moons even sent many a human across any number of worlds completely insane, and cults began to spring up worshipping the Orc beast. The High Lords of Terra facing such an unstoppable threat were as usual bickering amongst themselves about what to do. Black Templar's Marshal Bohemond and the only surviving Imperial Fist Captain Corland would activate the Last Wall Protocol. This order is designed to reunite the successor chapters of the Imperial Fists into a legion size once again should Terra itself come under threat. This is a highly contentious order as it goes directly against all the lessons that should have been learned from the heresy that no one Space Marine force should wield such immense power as a Legion, and this is why Space Marines are now split into chapter sizes. The Imperial Fists buck this idea along with others like the Dark Angels. For the Imperial Fists now though, this was a necessity, having been all but obliterated by the green-skinned menace. Next would follow the Battleport of Sanctus, as a large force of anything estimated at half a segmentum fleet arrived. It's difficult to estimate the numbers of such an Imperial fleet, but you can be assured it would be in the many hundreds if not thousands of vessels. The scale of what a segmentum fleet constitutes likely varies for each segmentum, and the period in which you would measure such a thing anyway. But regardless, it was a disaster. After weeks of attempting to smash through Orc asteroid fortifications, it was clear that the Imperials were simply outmatched and could not break the insatiable war thirst of the Orcs. Because the Orcs were able to use smaller craft and then teleport Orcs on board Imperial ships, even with their void shields intact, this proved immensely problematic, because Orcs in a confined space versus Imperial Navy crew, who were more often than not more like a ship labour force than some elite fighters, it was a bloodbath on board the ships, Orcs crushing, grinding, bones ripping crewmen in half, heads popping like grapes. Any such situation for the Navy resulted in a horrific slaughter. But still, the Orcs were not the refined fighting force or tacticians the Imperials were, and a weakness appeared in the Orc battle lines. The decision was taken that this was an opportunity that could not be missed, and so the Imperial Navy committed to piercing the chink in the Orc armour, or they would be destroyed in the process. This near-suicidal assault was a desperate act of much frustration as much as it was opportunity, and it would, with hindsight, not be a wise choice. Losses were very, very high, but the repeat focused fire of the Imperials weakened the Orc attack moon's void shields, and then they were able to destroy its gravitic generators from the inside as bombardment continued from the outside. The Orc attack moon was destroyed. Any celebrations though would be short, for the cost of the victory had been immense, and it soon seemed irrelevant as an Orc attack moon would phase into real space directly over Terra itself. Which brings us to one of the worst follies of mankind, the Proletarian Crusade, if you could call it a crusade. The Orcs had already expanded their campaign across the galaxy, and every segmentum saw bitter, heavy fighting. Once a warg gathers this kind of pace, it's self-perpetuating and very difficult to stop the sheer weight of momentum behind it. This is by design, and why the Orcs were so successful at such a rampage, the likes of which had rarely been seen before. In fact, it was so successful, they had even begun to assault Chaos Marine worlds around the edge of the Eye of Terra. At Holy Terra itself, the arrival of the attack moon spread instant understandable panic and blind fear. Mars refused to aid Terra, and the Arbites were concerned with maintaining what little order could be controlled on the planet itself. With the fleet having suffered such heavy losses and other battle fleets already deployed and engaged across the galaxy, Terra seemed defenseless. The Imperial Palace itself and the High Lords of Terra and the Emperor always had strong defences, but this did not apply for the planet as a whole. The only option suggested by one of the High Lords of Terra overseeing the merchant fleet Joskina Tol was a so-called Proletarian Crusade, the idea being that millions of civilian volunteers and ecclesiarchy militia would form the largest civilian mobilisation in Imperial history. For the other High Lords, this seemed madness, but it went ahead nonetheless. After a significantly small amount of planning, which amounted to little more than let's just shove them up there and let them get on with it, civilian craft from large-scale mass conveyor merchant ships to small shuttles flew towards the Orc attack moon. On board were millions of civilian crusaders, some guardsmen and arbiters. The Orcs almost instantly began to board the ships and inflicted severe losses on the poor, untrained plebs aboard. But perhaps positively or not, a majority of ships, by the sheer scale of the assault, made it through to deploy onto the Orc moon itself. Millions of civilian troops were landed, including 100 battle tanks, 50 chimeras and even some hellhound variants. Despite suffering horrors never imagined by many of the civilian fighters, the sheer weight of numbers were able to push the Orcs back. Despite the confusion, panic, fleeing and despair, it was working to a degree, or so it appeared to. This would be until the humans were approaching a gateway that led to the interior of the moon itself. The Orcs, with their strange power of being able to just will things to occur, revealed that they had constructed mechanisms that reached up through the stone itself. The mountains walked. The humans were so baffled by what they saw, their minds couldn't even accept it at first. The Orcs had forced the surface of the moon itself to envelop and crush the entire invading army in a bizarre event none could have anticipated. The vast waves of blood from the crushed force surrounded the feet of the humans as it surged like a torrent from all the crushed civilian fighters, a swelling mass of broken human bodies pushed together by the encroaching mountains barely 10 meters apart now. Any humans alive were drowning among the blood and bodies. It was a true nightmare. It was simply a disaster that was off the scale, an appalling plan, poorly executed, and then suffering the loss of all but a few through the bizarrity of the Orc menace. There was no silver lining, only absolute misery. Things would only become more bizarre when one of the civilian ships returning to Terra, carrying, of all things, an Orc ambassador who demanded surrender or death as options to the High Lords. The disturbing event only caused more bickering among the Imperials as they struggled to decide who was more to blame for such disastrous events. Ultimately, with the arrival of the Imperial Fists, or should we say the arrival of the Imperial Fists Legion, through the Last War Protocol, along with some persuaded aid from the Mechanicus of Mars, they were able to destroy the Orc Gate on the attack moon, destroy the War Boss, and secure it. However, the Astartes would quickly come under stern criticism from the High Lords of Terra for essentially reforming their Legion. Described as being borderline heretical, they were forced to break this up immediately. In my opinion, not punishment enough. Corlan, though, of the Imperial Fists had had enough of the High Lords' ineffective leadership and was ready to lead a political coup, which the High Lords buckled under instantly, declaring Corlan the new Lord Commander of the Imperium. The whole campaign around the Orc Beast is well known, but long and complex. Further power struggles would occur leading through and up to the end of the war. The Imperial Fists would be reformed from an amalgamation of their successor chapters. The Eldar would also become embroiled in the whole affair, and the attack moon over Terra was far from fully dead. For my thoughts though, it was the sheer and absolute insanity of the Proletarian Crusade that goes down for me as one of mankind's most absurd defeats. Sending a mass force of civilians against a rampaging Orc warg? The only positive takeaway would of course be that so many humans actually stood up and took the task on board, as well as preventing Orcs from infesting the planet, but even so, it's very hard to see it in a good light. Now, as seems to be the case these days, this video has become far longer than anticipated, so we'll be continuing the remaining five in part two, where we'll look at further annihilations of successor chapters, the forgotten wars of the Dark Angels, abject lessons in humility, and the worst disaster to befall the Imperium of Man. As always, thanks for watching. I'll see you very soon in part two.